In our time, science and technology cannot play an integrating role, precisely because of the infinite richness of knowledge and the speed of its evolution, which have led to specialization and its obscurities. But literature has been and will continue to be, as long as it exists, one of the common denominators of human experience, through which human beings may recognize themselves and converse with each other, no matter how different their professions, their life plans, their geographical and cultural locations, their personal circumstances. It has enabled individuals in all the particularities of their lives to transcend history. As readers of Cervantes, Shakespeare, Dante, and Tolstoy, we understand each other across space and time, and we feel ourselves to be members of the same species because, in the works that these writers created, we learn what we share as human beings. What remains common in all of us under the broad range of differences that separate us? Nothing better protects a human being against the stupidity of prejudice, racism, religious or political sectarianism, and exclusivist nationalism than this truth that invariably appears in great literature, that men and women of all nations and places are essentially equal, and that only injustice sows among them discrimination, fear, and exploitation. Mario Vargas Llosa, in his essay, Why Literature? Welcome to Delmarva today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This is the first of three special one-hour editions of Delmarva today, the first to be broadcast this morning, and the remaining two the last Friday in March, the last Friday in April. The purpose of this series is to look at literature and the other humanities as a way of exploring our grasp of truth, positive critical thinking, acceptance of cultural diversity, empathy, personal history, respect for others, honor, justice, and confidence in the future that have been so battered over the past 4 years. In the midst of this year-long pandemic and years of divisive political turmoil, what have we lost of confidence in ourselves and each other? And how might the humanities help us regain a sense of normal equilibrium? This morning, my guests are Professors Adam Wood and Martin Paraboom. We will discuss the nature of the humanities and the role they play in the development of our personal and national identities. Adam Wood is a professor in the English department at Salisbury University, and Martin Paraboom is a professor of history and dean of the Fulton School of Liberal Arts at the university. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here today.
Martin, let me turn to you first, and then Adam, you feel free to join in. I know you guys interrupt each other all the time. So in this instance, don't fear, Adam, to put your foot in the mix
I always am willing to stick my foot in it.
Yeah, well, we're all capable of that. Martin, let me ask you, to tell us about the humanities. What are the humanities? And why should we or would we turn to them in what I would call this reconstruction period after a lot of political turmoil also the pandemic that we've experienced as well?
Right. Well, broadly speaking, the humanities refers to the study of everything that makes us human. So it's big, right? More specifically, it refers to academic disciplines and the way that we as human beings have organized ourselves to advance knowledge, most often in the context of educational institutions, higher education, universities and colleges. And those disciplines then break down into divisions where we focus on different facets of the human experience with a focus on human culture, most specifically. So we have disciplines like literature, the study of literature, history, the study of the human experience, philosophy, the exploration of what it means to know, the meaning of life, and so forth, and other academic disciplines as well that we don't necessarily focus on at Salisbury University necessarily, but things like jurisprudence, right? Ways that we as human beings have figured out the rules of engagement, how to keep us from, you know, tearing each other apart. So that's kind of relevant to the introduction that you just made. But those are academic disciplines. And one of the issues I think that we face is that in the society at large, humanities doesn't necessarily resonate the way the arts do, for example. People readily understand what you're talking about when you talk about the arts, the performing arts, the visual arts. There's something tangible, something you can hear, something you can see. The humanities, I think once you break it down, becomes pretty comprehensible when you're talking about literature or history or philosophy, but the term humanities itself might be a little obscure for a lot of people. And that's why I think it's especially important now to talk about public humanities. In other words, beyond the academic disciplines and what we do in the hallowed halls of academia, we really need to re-engage with the inquiries and the aspects of our human experience that really inform those humanities. In other words, we tell stories, right? That's why we have literature. We reflect on our experience. We try to learn from it individually and collectively. That's why we have history. We think about what it all means. Why are we here? The curiosity about our existence and our communities. That's broadly speaking what philosophy is about. So I think it's really important for us in these times to re-engage the broader community in what we do. And sort of hold ourselves to account as academics to ensure that we're keeping it real and that however specialized we may be within the confines of our academic disciplines, that we remind ourselves and are very sort of transparent about the essential human qualities that we're really trying to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I would just kind of jump in and sort of echo on that in some ways. Hal, you and I have had conversations about sort of tensions and linkages between the sciences and the humanities. And one of the things that helps me sort of frame this in some ways is that science is what helps us understand the physical world, where the humanities help us understand our experience of that world and each other within that world. I wanted to circle back around to something that Martin had said just a second ago and maybe ask him to expand on that. Martin, when you talk about the increasing role of public humanities, in essence, something even like this, a conversation like this, is one of the challenges of the humanities that it has at least appeared to connect less to, the average person on the street and seem to become much more sort of insular, much more interested in itself than in connecting to the world at large. Is that one of the challenges that you see in the humanities right now?
Absolutely. I think it's in the nature of academics to specialize, right? And we build our academic reputations and our careers on specialization to be the most knowledgeable person on this particular subject. And that has led us really across academic disciplines, you're talking about the sciences and social sciences as well, to be very specifically focused on something quite possibly at the expense of the bigger picture. So to the degree that we are specialized, it becomes that much more challenging to sort of re-engage with a broader audience. That's why I as a historian appreciated actually becoming a professor and being required to teach world civilizations. In other words, taking broad swaths of the human experience across cultures, across time, and sort of get out of my area of specialization and really sort of think about what it's all about. What does it mean? What are the bigger narratives that we can identify? And to the degree that that kind of leads to a certain understanding of how the human story has evolved, that gives you kind of at least a basis for engaging a broader public to talk about that and why it's important. Now, the narrow perspectives and even the broader perspectives can be affected by and shaped by a particular outlook. And we always have to be open to that outlook being challenged by new information and new understanding. So if we're talking about, whether we're talking about literature or history, of course, in literature, we struggle with the issue of the canon, right? That we have revered certain writers and come to realize over time that, oh, this needs to be a bigger tent, right? We need to bring in more perspectives and deepen our understanding of the human experience from multiple perspectives. That's been another challenge of academia, I would say, that again, the way we've organized ourselves as human beings into academies historically has been exclusive, right? And elitist, even prejudiced for sure, right? Where you think about the institutions of higher education that 100 years ago we were to revere, those were exclusive, all white, male dominated for sure, academies with every limitation that comes with that. And so that is certainly part of our contemporary challenge as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point. It goes to sort of something that Hal was hinting at sort of earlier, that very often, at least classically, we conceive of the humanities as having some connection to an idea of nation, right? Or culture in a broader sense, right? When we think about the sort of origins of how we think about the humanities in the United States, it's a foundationally European model, right? I even think the sort of opening quote that Hal was using, you know, we have reference to Cervantes, Shakespeare, Dante, and Tolstoy, all, you know, predominantly sort of this European sort of sense of things, is one of the, you know, you mentioned the canon, right? The literary canon for the longest time was, you know, the sort of old joke of the dead white man, Milton, Chaucer, Shakespeare, even in history, right? Whose stories were getting told, whose stories were getting studied, underwent a fairly radical shift, it seems, in the United States. You know, say in the, starting perhaps in the late 1950s, but predominantly in the 1960s, where we saw a shift in the objects of study, right? So a broader array of literary texts, as well as historical documents, historical voices, and things like that. Has that, do you think, challenged the idea of the humanities that Hal kind of introduced us with as this thing that can fundamentally bring all people together, right? If we add more and more perspectives to the mix, on the one hand, it does make the tent larger, but it also makes the idea of a unified narrative much more complicated.
One of the things, Martin, before you chime in, let me introduce a kind of another thought that you alluded to, Martin, in your discussion, and that is the sense that the humanities, as you said, is fairly easy to categorize when we talk about academia, and the many disciplines and the kind of silos that each one of these built. So we can talk about those, and that's very clear. But Adam, coming to this broader picture, what is the link between these humanities and the man or woman driving to work in their car this morning? They are not academicians, and yet they deal in this world on a level that the humanities reflects, I believe. So think a moment about that link between the humanities as expressed in the academic community and the nature of the humanities that all of us experience in our daily lives.
Adam, did you want to jump in on that one?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that sort of comes to my mind, and I think that this is a challenge certainly that the humanities is facing, and perhaps the arts as well, is that we exist now in a moment with sort of a proliferation of cultural productions, right? Where we, you know, before the internet or television or even these sort of things, right? That we had the written word as sort of the primary thing that we went to. And so we sought out history as written in books. We sought out literature as written in novels or poems or short stories. Where in the contemporary moment, we are much more sort of saturated with film and television. And so it's interesting that we've even seen, you know, the so-called study in the humanities have to expand itself to include those sort of things, right? That we have within the humanities now media studies, film studies, television studies, things like this, that in many ways seem to be rising up to fill a gap. And again, what the average person might be consuming, right? We can no longer assume literary readership on a broad scale or people reading historical tomes on a large scale, where most of this stuff is transmitted, again, more through what we would like to think of or perhaps describe as popular culture. But has popular cultures in some ways become part of the new humanities in that way? I mean, again, when film first came on the screen, a lot of people were like, oh, this isn't a legitimate thing. This is just a fad. And the same thing with television. I think we've gotten to the point where we can't say that anymore, obviously. Much of what we talk about in terms of humanistic connection, the references are more often these days to film or television. And so Martin, maybe to sort of kick it back to you, does this devalue the humanities, or is it just sort of the humanities having to accept historical changes?
I think that, again, the humanities kind of owe it to themselves and to humanity to embrace every form of expression. And as someone who deeply appreciative of the film medium in particular, recognize that medium has grown and evolved from the early days where it had to overcome being sort of likened to, you know, prestidigitation, right, magic shows, and become a legitimate form. And of course, in the early days, it was just short little snippets of footage, and that evolved into something that looks a lot like, you know, kind of what literature does. It tells stories and it's scripted, and they became longer and more complex. So that's, I think, it's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing, right? as far as being yet another form of human expression, that is widely embraced and has a great deal of potential, as well as a number of downsides. To go back to your earlier question about, sort of the way that the humanities have, in some ways, I from one perspective, fragmented since the 1950s, or maybe even earlier. You know, I think we might sort of look back with wistful eyes to a time of, you know, of unity, but of course it was unity at whose expense. If you think about sort of I'll just jump into the idea of myth here for a moment. That was my favorite class as an undergraduate, classical mythology, because the big reveal there was that mythology wasn't, you talk about myths and you think, well, that's false, right? That's a myth, that's not true. But in fact, what myth has done is sort of encapsulate what we actually embrace to be essentially true about ourselves. And so something like Manifest Destiny, we would call sort of a founding myth, right? That is the notion that somehow, you know, it just happens to be our destiny to expand across the American continent at the expense of indigenous peoples while enslaving Africans to plow the land on our behalf. That's a very sort of self-serving myth, and it's one that sort of grows. It's not something that one person made up, but kind of collectively developed as a way of justifying a very violent process whereby, you know, the West was quote unquote won. So the fact that we have come to look at that with more critical eyes is a good thing. But it does also mean that there's lots to sort of debate, right? And that history isn't as neat and tidy as we would like it to be, or we might hope it to be. I don't hope it to be. I like complexity. I like ambiguity. And so all of the humanities really are should be these contentious terrains where we struggle with the ambiguity of the human experience. And in history, for example, the fundamental tension between, on the one hand, violence, right, which is an essential aspect. I mean, something you have to talk about when you talk about the human experience, and then turning around and trying to establish order and peace and laws so that the violence doesn't continue once you've, you know, taken by force the land. And that's just, you know, ethically, of course, and just in terms of human goodness and decency, a profoundly challenging notion. But that's our reality. That's one of those big questions that the humanities needs to struggle with.
I love ambiguity. And if you think about it, we live with it all the time. And it would be rather boring if there were no ambiguity. But Adam and Martin, one of the things I had in mind when I mentioned the link between the humanities and our everyday work life experience life is the thing that it seems to me, even though you two jumped off into the arts and the visual arts and so forth, that's good. But the thing that I thought of that encompasses actually all of those is language and the development of language. And I would suggest that probably one of the greatest contributions of the humanities is the development and refinement of language. Without language, there's no thought. Without thought, there really is no humanity. And so I'm even in the visual arts, we look at something and even a film, and we appreciate it and think it's wonderful. And then somebody says to us, "What do you think?" And all of a sudden, we're thrown back on language, on how we talk about what we experience. Do you sense the significance of the humanities to the development of language beyond the academic community and the fact that these last 4 years we have been subjected to an incredible use of language that we kind of shake our heads at. So I guess to boil it down, how do you see the relationship between the humanities and the development of language?
Yeah, if I could jump in first, I think it's a really interesting notion. When you were talking about language, I was thinking about Martin talking about sort of the mythologies course that he had taken. And that, you know, language really is, I think, sort of primary in this. And again, taking this back to the humanities at large, that we can in some ways perhaps think of the humanities as the stories or the narratives we tell ourselves about ourselves, right? Which can, you know, in the classic idealized sense of the humanities, they were the truths that we tell ourselves about ourselves, right? And so when we think about the original notion of the humanities, the great texts that we're supposed to pass on these eternal, you know, universal truths. But one of the things that we also recognize about both language and the narratives that we construct out of language is that these narratives can also be the lies that we tell ourselves about ourselves, right? The ways in which we justify, as Martin was really, I think, keenly pointing out, some terrible things that we have done in the course of the human endeavor that we've sought to explain to ourselves and justify in some ways, right? You know, were there people who were writing their narratives during, for example, the time of slavery that Martin mentioned, who acknowledged how horrible they were for enslaving people and stealing land? Perhaps there were, but when we think about so many of the narratives, for example, that came out of the American South during slavery, they were narratives designed explicitly to explain and justify the role of slavery, for example, right? And so again, when we think about those narratives that, you know, because we are human beings, we are going to not only perhaps lie to others, right? It's one of the most popular things we do with language, but we also think about the ways in which we lie to ourselves, right? That we tell stories to ourselves about ourselves. And again, I think the shaking up that I sort of referenced in terms of the humanities that, you know, really starting, say, in the 60s and moving forward, I think in some ways was an attempt to point out that we do also give ourselves false narratives, right? And I think, again, we've seen this, as you mentioned, how we've seen the importance and the peril of narratives in the recent years, right? If, you know, we think about the grand political divide in America right now, there are two distinct narratives going on here that seem to have very little connection to each other somewhere in the middle, which again comes back to the sort of notion of there is often a tension between how we represent ourselves and historical facts, right? Which again goes to these ideas of interpretation. I think much of what the humanities does in the academic sense is interpretations of these sort of raw documents that we have, be they literary texts or historical documents. And the modes of interpretation, I think, have changed in many ways since the 1960s, to kind of go back to that point.
And it's definitely gotten more complicated. And yet, I think what we may be in search of is sort of a replacement sort of grand narrative, right? That notion that somehow there is a story that embraces the whole thing. And you can think about manifest destiny and that notion as it kind of expanded and took root in the consciousness as being an attempt at that. But that was a very exclusive vision, right? It was very sort of self-justifying. It sort of brushed aside the real moral challenges of the violence that process of westward expansion entailed. And as we now have to come to grips with our identity as a diverse nation of multiple peoples, in terms of our cultural diversity, we're all essentially, and we are all human beings, and we have to embrace our common humanity as well. And in doing that, is there a grand narrative? Is that, are we kind of looking for that? Is that, or is that just going to be an elusive quest? Maybe we just have to embrace that ambiguity and understand that it's complicated and messy, and that there are multiple stories. Everyone has their own story. We have our collective story, but there's not going to be a neat tie it up with a bow grand narrative to pull it all together. And I wonder if that's something that we kind of aspire toward in a sort of a futile sense.
When the humanities were institutionalized in a sense, and I know, Adam, you have talked about this. Mm-hmm. I think it's something about the Second World War, this sense of institutionalizing the humanities and the concept of ambiguity. Makes me think of that, because when the humanities were institutionalized, and let me put it another way, when our thinking about the humanities was institutionalized within the academic framework, what did we lose when we did that? What of the humanities, what of the ambiguity, which is what made me think of it, what is the great ambiguity of human expression was lost when we institutionalized the humanities?
I mean, I can speak towards literary studies, and then perhaps Martin can jump in with historical perspective and sort of perhaps a broader perspective. But, you know, when the study of literature was institutionalized, and again, it had begun before World War II, but when we see at the end of World War II with the GI Bill, the, you know, explosion rate of universities, in literary studies, the sort of dominant approach was this very, very formalistic approach. And so that even though There may have been an acknowledgement that there are ambiguities in literature. There became almost a much more sort of scientific approach in terms of evaluation, right? So if anyone has seen the old film, Dead Poets Society, right? I don't know if this is still one that people watch, but the old teacher before the new hip teacher arrives, you know, the old teacher has them turn to a page in a textbook where they're in essence charting out the success of a poem, right? So its beauty was on one side, and I can't remember what the other one was. But the institutionalization of at least literary studies in that way actually sought to remove ambiguity in some ways, that it sought to sort of, and again, it was sort of, these are the best and brightest texts of our generation, and we're just going to tell you why they're wonderful and beautiful, where there was not room in any ways for pushback against that, right? There was a sort of singular view of what literature was supposed to do and of the types of literature that we looked at. And again, it was, you know, again, the New Critics very much sort of formalized this. There, you know, there were textbooks on how to read a poem, as opposed to thinking about the humanistic interaction of an individual with a poem or something like that. It made the teaching of literature much easier, though, right? If you take out ambiguities and things like that, it's much easier to go in and lecture and, you know, talk about, you know, some sonnet or something like that and say, look, oh, here's ambiguity. But in the last two lines, it resolves, right? Again, it was, you know, less than 20 years.
Martin, Adam, let me interrupt you for one moment there to say that, yes, it's much, much easier. But it removes the human equation, and it removes the challenge that the poem asks the reader.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was the sort of old model that sort of really, you know, took hold after World War II. Martin, is that, do you think, accurate in the humanities in general, or is that sort of special to literary studies?
Well, I think it would be a more specific example of a general tendency that in academics and to make an academic career, you face sort of certain hurdles and certain requirements that you know, explicitly or implicitly incline you to conform to a certain standard, right? Or to aspire to a particular notion of success. So you want that endowed chair at Harvard. That is supposed to be the holy grail that we all aspire to as academics. And so you write, I would argue that you write in a certain way. You write a certain kind of scholarship that is definitely vulnerable to trends, right? And to modes of inquiry, things that are fashionable even at a certain time. There would have been a time where you would be all Marxist, and you know, writers like David Lodge have very wittily skewered academic culture in a few decades past now, probably. But we're as vulnerable to that trendiness as anybody. And I don't think that trendiness necessarily serves the greater good, which I think the humanities are especially well equipped, given the scope of our inquiry, to address. What is that greater good? What is the common good today? And so I think specialization and the demands and peculiarities of academic culture don't necessarily press us to become, don't encourage us certainly to become activists, right? And I wonder if that's really something that we should be thinking about now. Especially thinking in terms of public humanities, how can the big questions that we ask and engage really bring communities together in our fragmented world around these big questions? Academic culture doesn't support that necessarily, and so that's something that we really have to examine.
Is that, just to bounce off of that, is that, do you think, Martin, part of a hostility that we see towards the humanities in certain segments of American culture right now, that in some ways, if I'm sort of following what you're saying, is that the humanities have not really done itself any favors in terms of trying to get a larger audience to understand the importance of what we do?
That specialization hasn't helped us, right? And sort of the making the grade, getting tenure and promotion at an elite private institution, which is supposed to be the ultimate aspiration, doesn't really encourage us to think big or to go bold, and really to go out into the community when the gods to be pleased are our senior colleagues in our departments or the administrators at the institution, rather than the communities that we're part of. I'd say at a public university where the setup is a little bit better for that, to be responsive to the needs of the community. But again, there is a hierarchy in American higher education, for good or ill, that that upholds the private institution as the best institution, and the public is sort of serving everybody else. Mm. So that's definitely a piece of it. But I think that is really the challenge in front of us, that I think the humanities can and should be, must be engaging our communities I think ultimately look to see if there can be some truth and reconciliation and healing in a badly fractured society. I think that the things that we understand and the questions that we ask are the questions that we need to engage the broader community with.
Yeah, just real quick, I think what you point out, Martin, is almost an interesting sort of irony that when we think about the expansion of the humanities that sort of, again, takes place starting sort of in the 60s, right, that sort of broadening of the tent in terms of the texts and authors and historical perspectives that we include, right, becomes much broader. But at the same time, there seems to be less interest in actually connecting with people outside of the humanities, right? And so there's sort of an interesting tension of growing the tent, but not caring about those who exist outside of the academy.
Right. And the tent doesn't get any bigger because just in the nature of academics and let's just say that the broader forces at work in a, let's say, a neoliberal type economy, that higher education itself is a thing, right? And that depending on the disposition of state legislatures, higher education will or will not be favored. Higher education becomes sort of more commodified. People are looking at higher education to train students rather than to educate them, especially at the undergraduate level. So all of that is a big issue as well. And I would even say that something that on the face of it is a good thing, like STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Yes, you know, we love our academic disciplines and we need all of them. But that inadvertently or inadvertently pits us against each other in the academy, makes us competitors where really, especially I think in terms of undergraduate education, that needs to be a unified effort, particularly when there are, you know, there is a way of thinking out there, and it's not universally shared, but that higher education in general is seen as the wrong side of a culture war, when in fact higher education, of course, is critical to our continued economic development.
Well, this is certainly true in educational circles and in the academic community. And I did want to ask you, but in a moment, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between the humanities as education, and you alluded to this, Martin, and skill development as education, in a sense. So my sense, if I'll get my two cents worth in here, and you can respond to it, is that whether you're a scientist or whether you are a doctor, whether you are whatever in these magnificent skill professions, including the law, that we have, as Adam said earlier, what you bring to that practice, what you bring to that thinking, is your own identity and your sense of what life is all about. And it's going to dictate to some degree how you perform. When you're a doctor, when you're an attorney, when you're a scientist or whatever. And so my sense is that one of the great benefits or necessities of the humanities is that it is the humanities that create in us the base of who we are, regardless of what else we do. We are going to bring that person to the endeavor. Does that make any sense in this discussion?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. The humanities is sort of the terrain in which you put it all together, right? You kind of synthesize an understanding, at least, you know, say you're an undergraduate, as a 21-year-old, who you are, how you fit into the bigger picture, what is the meaning of the community around me, what's the meaning of the world, where is this all going to end, where did we come from? All of those questions are essential humanities questions, and any sort of curious, thoughtful person who's who's going to make his or her way in a knowledge-based economy has to be a thoughtful person. And so I think that curiosity and that sort of intellectual creativity is really foundational to getting the most out of life professionally and in every other way. So the humanities, I think, play an absolutely essential role in undergraduate education, because that is that place where, as a young adult, you're kind of charting your course, right? Personally, professionally, as a citizen, and every opportunity that you have to develop some kind of understanding, right? Some kind of model, some kind of worldview that certainly has to be open to being challenged down the road, right? We all evolve. We all, it's a journey, right? And just going back to that, the notion of skills as well, the idea that so many of our liberal arts graduates are, you know, they're not going to get a job. I'm a liberal arts professional, right? It's they're doing any number of different things out there in the world where their professional journey might take them, and they don't land into a job the way our more professionally focused programs will. A nursing degree will take you into a job as a nurse. A liberal arts education is foundational to a whole bunch of different things, including potentially nursing, just as nursing students get a liberal education to some degree. But that piece of the undergraduate education, I think, is something that is often overlooked when we look at major programs, for example, and really neglecting the importance of general education, which is too often sort of relegated to ticking a bunch of different distributional boxes, jump these hurdles and we will give you a degree, we'll give you your prize. And going back to that notion of skills, the general education piece is really where you're thinking about those really important skills, actually, that are going to be super helpful to you as you make your way professionally. That's critical thinking. That is writing, effective oral and written communication. It's creative thinking. It's being able to navigate the world of technology and its changes. It's being able to work effectively with others. It's being able to navigate cultural differences. That the undergraduate experience in particular is super formative, I think, and critical to sort of setting the stage for a successful adult life in all of those realms.
How about continuing education? Again, our man and woman driving to work this morning, they're kind of set. What would you suggest outside the academic institution that we need to do generally in terms of our appropriation of the humanities?
Well, I think that especially the setup for a public university is terrific, right? And I think Salisbury University in Salisbury welcomes the community when there's not a pandemic on a pretty much daily basis to all kinds of programming. And many, many people living in Salisbury take regular advantage of the cultural offerings, whether those are in the realm of the arts or the humanities, lectures, performances, shows, and so forth. So that's clearly an important part of people's continuing education, and recognizing that the activities that you participate in as a student are activities that you continue to enjoy the rest of your life. I always, you know, I'm a busy university administrator, but I always have to have a work of literature on my bedside stand that maybe has something to do with something that I teach or touch on in terms of my professional life. But that's just how I roll.
Yeah, I mean, I would chime in with just one thing, sort of piggyback off something Martin said, and again, the sort of notion of the conflict that, or some people see it as a conflict between the notion of content versus skills, right? I think the older model of the humanities was very much content focused, And again, was able to do that because the texts that it, or the histories or whatever we might say, that it was selecting as the most important things were fairly limited, right? And so again, that you could have, I mean, I still remember when I was in PhD school, Georgia State University, and there was a required literature course that all students had to take, and it was just called World Literature, and it was all the literature of all the world over all time in one semester or less, I guarantee it. and even though that's an impossible task, obviously, when those kinds of courses were originally created, it meant very specifically, here are the handful of texts that you'll look at, right? Where what we've seen is, again, with that explosion of text, right? You think about something like the Norton Anthology of Literature, which used to be a fairly small tome that is now this multi-volume sort of thing, right? And so again, the idea of conveying to students through general education, the best and brightest of all, you know, minds of all time, is an absurd endeavor, right? Where I think the shift has been more to think about it now, you know, so for a literary endeavor, it's less to teach them the most important literary texts than to teach them the skills that they need to interpret any literary text when they come to it, right? I think history may be sort of similar to this. Instead of teaching them, again, as Martin referenced earlier, some grand narrative of history, of using history to say, here's how we interpret historical moments, that students can take that everywhere, right? Again, the sheer notion of the value of humanities exposure in general education used to be seen as valuable for itself, where now the questions, and they're legitimate questions, are, well, what are you going to do with that information? And again, is it more useful for me if I'm a business major or a science major or whatever it is, to be able to approach a literary text when I come to it and get what it's doing, as opposed to being able to you know, recite from memory 40 some lines of Shakespeare, right? And again, the current trend seems to be at least that the skill side is more important, that instead of teaching students who to be in the world, we're teaching them how to be in the world, if that distinction makes sense.
Well, in response to that, Adam, the arts, literature, and the other aspects of the humanities are in fact challenging. They challenge our view of ourselves. They challenge even works of art, good films. They all challenge the way we see ourselves in the world. And is this one reason why we want to perhaps avoid the challenge that people are not reading today? They're not reading what I would call challenging literature anyway. And I don't mean they're challenging because they're hard to understand. They're challenging because they challenge our views of the world and of ourselves. Your thoughts on whether you think that's one reason that we're in the broader world to some degree avoiding the difficult humanities.
Yeah, I think the challenge is fun, right? I mean, to the degree that we had certainty before, we were certain, it appeared, of things that were very self-serving, very simplistic, and actually ways of reinforcing, you know, using academics as the tool, a hierarchy and profound inequalities and injustices. And that doesn't mean that in sort of saying, yeah, we understand, we can now put it something like Manifest Destiny in context, that it is not, I mean, you can talk about it as a founding myth, but you have to contextualize that and recognize the role that it played in perpetuating those inequalities. But I think we do have some certainties, actually, as we look ahead, right? Because we have figured out from experience that democracy is the best form of government, or the worst form of government, except for all the others, right? That there really isn't an alternative. And so to the degree that we see a tendency toward authoritarianism in our own society. We are seeing that, obviously, and observing that around the world as well. We know where that has taken us before, right? Whether you're looking at the period between the world wars in Europe or anywhere else in the world. Human rights, those are a good thing, right? there are things that we can definitely champion at recognizing all of the ambiguities and complexities of the human experience that we have settled on as that is the way to go. There's no way back from recognizing the essential equality of human beings, right? And the quest for liberty. So there are some certainties certainly that we can embrace on behalf of all humanity. As we root out the inequalities and try to build a more just society. I think there is a vision out there that we can pursue. And the humanities can play a really important role, I think, in sort of clarifying that vision.
I think there's a flip side to that as well that goes to this notion of the challenge of the humanities, right? And in looking at ambiguity that, you know, if we think about our contemporary cultural moments, and again, I'm not obviously the first person to point this out, sort of the siloing of people, the sort of tribalism of politics and things like that, where there is, in many ways, I think a resistance to seeing human beings as fundamentally complex, right? If we think about the human individual, it's much easier to say, oh, that person thinks that, therefore we know everything about them, right? And we see this sort of both sides politically, where I think the power of the humanities is showing that being even an individual human is always very, very messy business, right? I mean, I think I'll be teaching in just a little while. We're working on William Dean Howells's late 19th century novel, A Hazard of New Fortunes. And not many people read this anymore, but one of the sort of central conflicts within it are sort of late 19th century robber baron practices versus labor movement, right? So there's a fictionalized representation of the Haymarket riots, for example, in this novel. But one of the things that this novel, I think, does very powerfully is that the character who is sort of the robber baron, right, the sort of ultra capitalist, is not presented as all evil all the time, right? In the same way that the socialist character in the novel, even though he espouses to be much more open to the needs of the working class, we see moments where he's kind of a horrible human being, right? And so we get this very complex sense of what it means to be a human. And again, I think that that's something that people really struggle with, particularly in the contemporary moment. They want to see everything in the simplest ways, right? And with this tribalism, it's I and my side are good and pure. Everyone else who disagrees with us is clearly evil all the time. And that's not how being a human works, right? That the humanities really draw our attention to the genuine complexities of even the individual human. And so again, you've got this sort of notion of exceedingly complex individuals in an exceedingly complex world that just cannot reduce itself down to simplicity. And this is where the humanities, I think, really have their purpose, right? To sort of remind us of our relationships to the world, but to remind us that these things are always messy, that you cannot reduce anything that has to do with the human experience down to generalizations.
Well, there are some aspects, tools that we can in fact use to help struggle with the ambiguities. And one of them, I think, Martin, you mentioned earlier, perhaps, or Adam, and that is the sense of critical thinking. I mean, we have now come through 4 years in which language and critical thinking has just been basically destroyed. I mean, any kind of order has really disappeared. Any kind of confidence has kind of disappeared. We have just a couple of minutes left. Say something about that tool of critical thinking of as people struggle with who they are and what this world is like and how they can grasp the direction of their sense of themselves with some kind of what I call positive critical thinking, because critical thinking can be used in a negative sense as well.
You know, the thing that sort of first came to mind is the idea of critical thinking in some ways goes towards the evaluation of the narratives that we're receiving, right? Again, we go back to this notion of narratives and language and the stories we tell ourselves. It's tricky because on the one hand, we want to say that all narratives are equally valued because they're the expressions of human beings. At the same time, that's simply not true, right? That there are some narratives that are pushing more disinformation than others. There are some narratives that begin with a faulty assumption and then kind of work from there. You know, think of this in terms of biblical scholars or historians, that if you want to make a point, you can always cherry pick something to make your point, but that doesn't make your point good. It doesn't make it well wrought. And that much of the idea of teaching students critical thinking is to help them discern between texts that are trying to at least be more transparent in their narratives and their interpretations of the world, right? Even that critical thinking, even if we encounter false narratives, critical thinking is what ideally can help us tell that they're false narratives, right? That we can take these things apart, that we've been equipped, or we've equipped our students to have those tools to take bad ideas apart.
We can apply those tools ourselves as well.
Right.
And ask that our neighbor use those kinds of tools in the construction of their language as well. Martin.
Yeah, I was just going to say that there's a, in critical thinking, we think about that as being using good evidence to develop an argument that will resonate in the minds of others. And so there's a really critical element of accountability there. And I think one of the things that we lament these days, and I think social media has created this phenomenon of creating these echo chambers. In other words, that accountability is really only to the people who already think like you, think the way you do, and not the wider body politic or culture at large. So we've become fragmented in that sense. But so I think the element of accountability is really the, because you could sort of argue a morally relativistic line that's, well, it's just kind of whatever you make of it. And yet that element of accountability, I think, points us back in the direction of, you know, but what are our values as a society, and wherever those come from, you know, we agree that people being free and people treating one another with respect and kindness and people respecting people's fundamental rights is something we have agreed upon. And to the degree that any of these arguments counter that, or would put somebody in power who would demolish our democratic institutions, we can say enough and say that, well, that's not gonna fly.
Well, let me end or begin to summarize again with Vargas Llosa's, I think, brilliant essay on why literature. And Llosa says the brotherly link that literature establishes among human beings, compelling them to enter into dialogue and making them conscious of a common origin and a common goal, transcends all temporal barriers. Literature transports us into the past and links us to those who in bygone eras plotted, enjoyed, and dream through those texts that have come down to us. Texts that now allow us also to enjoy and to dream. This feeling of membership in the collective human experience across time and space is the highest achievement of culture, and nothing contributes more to its renewal in every generation than literature. Adam and Martin, thank you both very, very much for a really exciting and stimulating discussion on the humanities and what the humanities bring to us. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.